You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Hello, friends. So glad you could join me today, you beautiful MFs. Today, I'm going to talk about hunting humans for sport. I'll tell you about an enjoyable Netflix series we just watched. I'll talk potential investments as the war rages in Iran, whatever it's called over there. I'll give you a quick history lesson on Iran. And I also want to say a few words about Lou Holtz, who died on Wednesday. I loved one of the books he wrote. And I've got a few highlights that I'll share with you. The book was called Wins, Losses, and Lessons. But as usual, I want to start with some funny stuff. Somebody named Eden Dranger, don't know if it's a guy or a girl, posted this. They said, I don't know what's longer, a microwave minute or watching a video while someone else is holding the phone insisting it's hilarious. Gene Parmesan of Black Twitter. He uses the ninjas word that I'm going to use so as not to be taken out of context and called racist. He didn't use ninjas. I'm going to use ninjas. But he says, ninjas be 31 years old and still believe in the Democrat Party with a bunch of laughing emojis. This is political comedy gold. I just saw this recently, but I think it's from 2024. The president of Argentina, Javier Milei, he said in a speech to thunderous applause, he said, the left can't applaud me because their hands are in other people's pockets. And here's something that's actually happening that I found hilarious. It says, ICE is now reportedly using undercover Subaru Outbacks to catch illegals off guard because it fools them into thinking it's a lesbian coming to save them. And then a couple of guys jump out to make the arrest. I know that sounds like a joke, but it is confirmed they're doing that. Nick Sorter posted a video of it, and it wasn't AI. The Rican memes, he posts a lot of great memes, and this one's probably funny because it's true. He says, Netflix is waiting for the conflict with Iran to end so that they can make a movie about a black Iranian guy who falls in love with a transgender Israeli soldier. We watched a show called The Beast in Me on Netflix last week. It's a short series. They only did one season. My mom recommended it to us, and we watched. My wife liked it more than I did, but it was enjoyable. I'll give it a 4 out of 5 stars. And part of the reason, or what I didn't like, I got turned off kind of early by the overacting. Like the main character, well, I guess there are two main characters. The guy I liked, his name was Niles Jarvis on the show. His character was great. The acting was good. And the main character, a woman, Aggie was the character's name. She was also good. But my problem was, I get that she was trying to act like she was this somewhat neurotic, anxiety-ridden author. But every line that she spoke had to be, it's just that I don't know. And I don't know who started doing that, the deliberate stutter. I think it was Rachel on Friends, if I had to guess. That's when I first noticed it. Remember how Jennifer Aniston's character would deliberately stammer and stutter her way through her lines? Like if she was talking about Ross, she'd say like, I just don't know if I can talk to you guys this way the whole show today, but it'd be fine if it was every once in a while because people do in real life. We all kind of do it, obviously. We all do it at times. I have a lot of them cut from this, if you're curious. My editor works on those because it bothers me to hear it, and I'm trying to work on it. But so I'm doing it again. I just thought the verbal tics were overdone by Aggie in The Beast in Me. And Netflix is so woke that usually the most competent people in Netflix shows are women of color. And this Beast in Me show is no exception. They had the gal who opposes Niles doing the Jarvis Yards project, who was this African-American girl boss, this alpha woman. And the other one, that stood out to me was this Asian woman who plays an FBI agent who's having an affair with Brian Abbott. He was the main FBI guy. And they are so not looks matched that it seems fantastical. Like they don't look like they would ever make love to each other, at least. And I turned to my wife and said aloud, I was like, there's no way that guy's sleeping with her. So shows should not do that. I saw where Susan Rice, who is on the Netflix board of directors, said recently that those who supported Trump these last 4 years are going to face, or these next 3 years, the 4 years that he's in office, are going to face retribution when the communists take power again. Of course, she didn't call them communists. But I believe her. I do think all of us who have opined on what I call the best movie ever, I think there's serious risk of being jailed under a future communist regime if those of us who opine keep talking. Scott Adams, the late RIP, the late Scott Adams, he was proven correct when he said that in the summer of 2020, that if Biden is elected, that Republicans would be hunted. And he was roundly mocked and laughed, of course, at the time. But he said that he could tell by the language they were using that this is what was going to follow if Biden were to be elected or installed, however you want to look at it. And sure enough, they immediately started hunting down the insurrectionists, quote unquote, hunting them to put them in a cage for as long as they could. Remember, I've told you, not the guys who bought the best props. Those, the guys who made the gallows, they didn't go after them, despite having all five of them on tape. And the big guy encouraging everybody to go into the Capitol, what was his name? Ray Epps. He only got a slap on the wrist. And even that, he only got after everybody started to notice that he was removed from the FBI's wanted list. And they're like, why, huh? Why'd they take him off? Was it 274 plainclothes agents they had in the crowd that day? Could 274 dudes make a difference? Yes. Think about what you could do that day at the Capitol with 274 guys dressed as Trump supporters. You could station them in 20 groups of 25 dudes all around the Capitol. 11 groups of 25 men, they could instigate just about anything. And shouldn't the CIA, with all the regime change that we engage in, overthrowing governments, wouldn't it be smart for the CIA to have these guys, these successful insurrectionists, why not have them teach the classes on how to do insurrections? Like, okay, class, first thing you do, you leave your guns at home, and we're only going to go into one building. So rather than bring guns to the insurrection, be sure to bring your selfie sticks. And they jailed Peter Navarro, which is so ridiculous. And of course, Charlie Kirk was hunted with a rifle. Taking him off the board was such a big thing for them, such a big deal. And they had success silencing Trump. He was kicked off of social media with no way to speak to the public. That's why he started his own social media company, Truth Social, which he still posts there. And when they were trying to lawfare him, he was gagged, so he couldn't talk about what they were trying to do to him. He was actually, quote-unquote, hunted in four different parts of the country. They tried to put him in a cage for as long as they could, just like the insurrectionists. And when that didn't succeed, we all kind of knew what was going to come next. He was hunted with a rifle, twice, or maybe more if you consider this Iran thing. Yeah, I find that interesting. So, because we're now at war with Iran, and I remember Tucker Carlson doubting Ted Cruz when he said that they had paid hitmen to kill Trump, and Tucker didn't believe him. And he said, if that's true, Tucker saying this, if that were true, we'd be trying to kill the Ayatollah, and we're not doing that. So if what you say is true, that Iranians are trying to kill Trump, why aren't we trying to kill the Ayatollah? And I know Tucker is now opposed to the action we've taken against Iran. He believes we're acting at the behest of Netanyahu. Are we? I don't know. And I don't think he does either. He likes to point out that the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, visited the White House 7 times in the past year, but we're not privy to those discussions, and neither is he. And the people making these decisions have way more information than we'll ever have. What do I think about it? I think a lot about all of this, and I'll share a few of my thoughts with you. But there are things I like about it and things I don't like. I know there are a lot of women, a lot of awfuls, who don't like Pete Hegseth. Of course, the booger rings don't like him. I mean, he's toxically masculine. He talks about, when he comes to the podium, he's talking about total domination of Iran. and being victorious. And that's the first time in my lifetime that I've ever heard a military leader talk like that, telling us what their objectives are and giving us frequent updates. It's the first time in my life, and it's refreshing. But yeah, blue-haired booger ring, booger rings hate them because they could never attract a man like that. A lot of uglies. You know what I like best about what Hegseth is saying? He's like, we are just getting started. And the reason I like that is because a lot of men, and I'll include myself in this, a lot of us have a tendency to get complacent when you're winning by a lot. So you have to remind yourself not to let up. And it doesn't matter like what I'm doing. I could be playing RBI baseball with my brother and it's 7-0. Well, maybe that's not a good example because you can 10-run rule somebody on RBI baseball. But you could have Roger Clemens on the mound just bringing so much heat that my brother can't even put the ball in play. And my self-talk, the way I talk to myself, the voice in my head is my old college coach. Because if we were winning, if we were way ahead, he would call us up out of the dugout to talk to us like in a huddle. And he would say, don't let up. When you have a man down, you stomp on his fucking balls. And I've never shared that with anybody before. So if you're someday playing me in RBI baseball or Tecmo or pickleball would be a good example. Now you know what's going to be going through my mind. You don't need to ask. As soon as you start mounting the tiniest of comebacks, I'm going to be thinking about my old coach saying that I need to stomp on your balls. So Lamborghini, no mercy. So as I talk about Iran here, just be mindful that what I share with you today, this isn't something you're going to be able to share with your leftist friends. Sorry about that. And why is that? Because it involves economics, and you can't expect a socialist communist to understand economics, because the old saying is true. If they understood economics, they wouldn't be a socialist, Marxist, communist. And as I said, ultimately, I don't know that I have a strong opinion either way, and maybe I'm reserving judgment until there's fallout. But I like the way things are. If I had to say right now, yeah, I'm all in favor. Of course, I'm a patriotic American. I support us. I support the president and our troops. And to the negative Nancys, there's a quote I want to read to you. It's from Colonel Nathan Jessup, played by Jack Nicholas and A Few Good Men. He said, I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I like that. One thing I really like, and again, this has never happened in our lifetimes, all these firsts. I like that for the first time, we have a bunch of Muslim countries on our side, on America, allying with America. And that's Jordan, Kuwait, the UAE, the Saudis, Qatar, Oman, and Bahrain. All those countries have sided with us, and I'm sure you've seen Iran is starting to attack just everybody around them. Whereas the only Muslim countries who don't seem to be allying with us are the British and the French. So let me say this before I'm going to get into some Iranian history. I trust that Trump is doing what he believes is in our long-term best interests, and that he has a rock-solid plan. And I think he's earned that trust from us by way of his other foreign policy successes. And I think he's way smarter and wiser than he has ever given credit for. I like the fact that Iran's leadership, who are all dead now, I like that they'll no longer be able to chant death to America or kill Americans with impunity, which is what they've been doing, either by themselves or by funding these proxies like Hezbollah in Lebanon, through Iraqi militias, Hamas, the Houthis. They've had so many ways to get us, and hopefully that's all coming to an end. So in 1983, Hezbollah carried out a suicide car bombing at the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, which killed 17 Americans. In October of that same year, this is 83, Hezbollah killed 241 U.S. military personnel in a truck bombing in Beirut. In 85, they kidnapped and killed, tortured actually, William Buckley and a few other Americans at that time in Lebanon. But they did terrible things to William Buckley. That's not the National Review William Buckley. That's the he was a CIA station chief out there at the time. In December 84, Hezbollah hijacked a plane from Kuwait that was flying to Tehran. the capital of Iran, which killed two Americans who worked for USAID. In 1985, there was another plane hijacked, which killed a U.S. Navy diver. July of 89, there was murder. Hezbollah killed a U.S. Marine Corps colonel by the name of William Higgins, which happens to be, that was my host dad's name in Kansas when I was playing ball in the summer up there. Bill Higgins, he has passed, RIP Bill. But that guy had been kidnapped previously, the year before. So I'm sure he was tortured too. And then in the 90s, you had Hamas and Palestinians doing jihad, killed a bunch of Americans in suicide attacks in Israel. 1996, a group with ties to the IRGC, which is Iranian Revolutionary Guard, kind of like the Ayatollah's personal force, Gestapo, I guess Tim Walz would call them. Well, he would call Americans the Gestapo, maybe not them. But yeah, they killed 19 U.S. airmen in Saudi Arabia. That was at the Khobar Towers building. And then during the Iraq War, which started in 2003, Iran's IRGC, again, they armed Shia militias, which led to the deaths of hundreds of U.S. troops in Iraq. And then more recently, this decade, since 2020, you had a January 2020 missile attack. That was, they called it retaliation for the drone strike on Soleimani. They launched missiles at an airbase in Iraq, and that nobody died, but it wounded several dozen of U.S. troops. In 2022, Iranian attacks in Syria and Iraq killed an American contractor and some other personnel. January of 24, there was some of that in 2023 too. January 24, they had a drone attack. Iranian-backed militants killed three U.S. service members. That was a drone attack in Jordan. October of 23, of course, that's when October 7th occurred, which that's probably the biggest miscalculation in the history of warfare. I don't know what they expected to come from that, but we're watching it. They had their proxies conduct over 180 attacks against U.S. forces in the Middle East, which caused even more casualties. Now, let me speak to the, I want to talk about the chess game that we're playing here. So Trump has been talking about how China's been screwing us since I was born. I was born in 80. He's been talking about China screwing us over since then. And this is something I think about. Like, if we don't know exactly, he tells us what he thinks, mostly tells us what he thinks, probably 95% of what's in his head. But if he thinks the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, teamed up with our own communists to release a virus to get rid of them, if he thinks that way and he's not telling us, I tend to think there's a lot that he's not telling us. But what he does know is he saw how cozy the Bidens were with Communist China and how many millions of dollars they were making by way of the CCP and Chinese energy companies. And he watched, remember when Gavin was groveling and cleaned up all the homelessness in San Francisco for one day when President Xi of China came for a visit? But that's just surface level stuff, the calculations or the machinations that he's forced to reckon with, the machinations of our enemies. He has to consider who is allied with who and what it's going to look like in the future. Like, as the global communists have banded together, Venezuela, Cuba, China, Iran, the Islamists and communists appear to be together in all this. They're allied, which is where the strategic chess game comes in, where you've got to be very smart. And fortunately, he is, because what Trump has done is strain the relationship between China and Russia. As I'm sure you've noticed, Russia and China have only offered diplomatic support, not military support, to Iran. And I even saw where China has condemned the attacks on Iran, which that's like Jim Jordan writing a strongly worded letter, I guess. But China is the largest buyer of Iranian oil. So now they face all these risks as it pertains to energy security, because most of the oil that they are purchasing from Iran that comes through the Strait of Hormuz, actually about a fifth of the world's oil passes through that strait. And Iran, they depend on China for their economic survival. But that dependence they have on China is being hit hard right now. And they're staying on the sidelines. And Russia, for its part, they're acting as more of a mediator rather than a direct ally of Iran. They're about as, it seems like they're as cozy as we are with the Spanish right now, because what they're doing is hedging their bets to preserve the relationship regardless of who ends up in power in Iran, which is, that's kind of what they did with Syria. They benefit in the near term by way of oil revenues, but they're not stupid. They don't want to tie their fate to the mess that's going on in Tehran right now. But the Venezuela connection is interesting. So following the seizure of their oil fields, this attack on Iran removes another adversary of ours, which has served as an oil producer for China. So this is almost as much an attack on China as it is on Iran. And the Venezuela-Iran connection is strategic also, because they're anti-US and they're allied in being anti-US. So their bond, for lack of a better word, was forged. They started this in early 2000s, and it was mainly to set up, well, it was set up to help, one, Iran establish a foothold in our hemisphere, which we don't like, but they also traded technology with them and military secrets. So basically the whole post-World War II order, the post-World War II world order is crumbling right now. The great unraveling, they're calling it. And it's led by Trump, who is probably the most consequential president of our lifetimes. Not even arguably, I wouldn't think. I hear the argument about Iran being at war with us since 1979 when they took Americans hostage, but I'm seeing too many idiots saying history didn't start in 79, that you need to read more because we started this mess by staging a coup in 1953. And I see them saying if you don't mention that the CIA overthrew them in 53, that you're lying by omission. But I happened to write a paper on Iran about 20 years ago because I was arguing with my then communist boss about it, and we would email back and forth, and I decided to turn it into an essay of sorts. And what I've seen discussed since this war in Iran started is why did we do that? Why would the CIA overthrow the government in 1953? So they're acting as though that's when history started. What it actually is happening, though, it's similar to what happened in Venezuela, who I've talked about before, that this commie, a boss of mine, was a huge fan of. He thought Hugo Chavez was the greatest thing ever, and that he was to be emulated. Well, just as Chavez nationalized oil in Venezuela, Iran did the same thing in the early 50s, and it started in 1951. And what nationalizing oil means, for those of you who don't know, it's all the oil that's underground in your respective country, as a country, what you have in the dirt, once it's nationalized, it belongs to the government. Nationalization is the opposite of privatization. So they effectively kick out all the oil companies and take control of the oil for themselves, saying it's theirs. It's in our backyard. Why wouldn't it be ours? That's our money. And your leftist friend who doesn't know anything, who makes up the rules as he goes and thinks contracts are optional or that the Constitution is a living, breathing document, they think, well, if the oil is underground in your own backyard, of course it's mine. And yeah, that makes sense unless you don't have the capital to even explore what's going on in your backyard, if you don't have the shovels to dig. And of course, they don't understand economics, which doesn't help. But the key part that they leave out in this instance, as it pertains to Iran, is that the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, or AIOC, as it was called, they're now called British Petroleum, they changed their name, they reached an agreement with the Persians back in 1901 to prospect for oil. Well, they didn't know if they would find oil when they started prospecting. And I don't think they had named themselves by then. It was a guy named William Knox Darcy, this Brit who led the exploratory efforts. And there was no guarantee they'd find anything at all. And they faced major logistical challenges. They had to transport all this heavy equipment, the drilling equipment, across rugged terrain, mountainous terrain. They operated in areas there was no infrastructure. There were no roads. There was no government set up. So there wasn't police or anything. So they had to hire their own security because there were tribal warlords. There was all this infighting among tribes out in these rural areas. and they were trying to kill them. So they faced disease. They faced, some of them died from disease. Some of them were killed by warlords. And not to mention, they were under intense financial pressure because they'd been operating for 2 or 3 years with zero return on investment. For those first 3 years, they found no oil. So 3 years of this, they pretty much exhausted their capital. But the agreement that the British had with the Persians, the contract they signed, granted these guys the right to explore and prospect for oil for 60 years. That's what they paid for, 60 years of speculation or of speculating for oil. That's what they wanted to do. So they're paying all this money. They have no guarantee of finding anything. This is a huge investment on their part. And then finally, after 7 years of arduous work and coming up empty, they struck oil in 1908. And that's when they became what is called the Anglo-Persian or Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, now British Petroleum, or BP, as I said. So fast forward to the year 1933. In 1933, Iran, then called Persia, signed a major, by the way, Persian, if you don't know, is the native Iranian ethnicity. So if you meet somebody from Iran, at least those that I have met through the years, they typically call themselves Persian, not Iranian. And the main reason they do that is because they want to dissociate themselves from the post-1979 government, the takeover, which I'll talk about in a minute. Now remember, a 60-year contract from 1908, that was set to expire, what, 1968-ish? Yeah. But the Shah decides, only, what, 24 years into the agreement, to cancel the contract with the Brits. Just null and void it, unilaterally. Just decided to cancel the agreement and brought the Brits back to the negotiating table. They wanted to renegotiate. Why would they do that? Because the Brits, by this time, were making buku return on their investment. So much, in fact, that Iran decided, oh, that's not fair. You're making all this money. It'd be like if I negotiated with the owners of a luge track. I talked about lugeing last week and bobsledding and skeleton. Like if I wanted to rent the building and while they had the track for many years, they never used it because they didn't have any equipment. They didn't have a bobsled, nothing. And we agreed to how long I was going to lease it for. And we agreed that if I win a prize for my excellent lugeing, that I will give you, the owner, 10% of the proceeds. Well, it takes me a while. I'm not good at it. I've never done it. So I go broke and some of my teammates die, but I keep going and eventually I win gold at the Olympics. And then the owners of the track come to me and say, that's not fair. 10% isn't fair. We want 50%. It's our luge track. It's in our backyard. So what are you going to do? There aren't that many luge tracks. You're forced back to the negotiating table to renegotiate the deal. So that's an analogy to keep in mind as I tell you how it all went down. So in 1933, Iran gets better terms on the agreement, better royalties, and extended the deal out another 60 years. And so now it's set to expire in 1993. Do you think Iran abided by the terms of the lease contract? Well, in 1951, they elect Mossadegh, was his name, on a platform of nationalization. That's what he ran on. He wanted to nationalize their oil, which is stealing. And once he was elected by their parliament, it wasn't like a direct democracy or anything, that's what he did. He nationalized what is now called BP in 1951. Which effectively ended decades of British oil drilling. So then the British and the Americans, fearing that they would lose all the access to the oil, and they were also worried about Soviet influence in Iran because this was at the start of the Cold War. So what the CIA did was they devised a plan to overthrow this guy, Mossadegh. And they used bribery, and they used propaganda, and they orchestrated riots, all in an attempt to destabilize their government. Sound familiar? And as a result of this CIA activity, this was 1953, August of 53, the coup succeeded. After lots of street protests and they had military involvement, they arrested Mossadegh, they tried him for treason, and they imprisoned him. And what happens from there? The Shah is installed, and he proceeds to rule as an autocrat, and that lasted until 1979. And there was an Iranian revolution, which that profoundly altered in a terrible way, relations between the U.S. and Iran. That's when Iranian militants seized the U.S. embassy in Tehran and took 66 Americans hostage initially. At first, it was 66. And then shortly thereafter, they released I think it was 13 of them, all women and African Americans released. And then they released another hostage a little later due to health issues. And after that, it was 52 Americans held hostage for 444 days. That is until January 20th, 1981, which was the date that Ronald Reagan was sworn in, and we got all our hostages back. Now, see if this sounds familiar. The Islamic Revolution was actually a Marxist revolution. The Islamists and communists buddying up, that's not a new thing. So now, as then, they teamed up together, the Marxists and the Islamists, and all throughout the 70s, leading up to 1979, when the revolution occurred, a large swath of the Iranian population embraced Marxism. And like most Marxist revolutions, it was mostly led by a demographic who lacked the if-then logic stream. It was mostly women who led the charge. Insensitive Jerk is an account on X. He pointed this out in a recent article I saw online. He said, if you hang out with leftists, you will understand the male-female dynamic in revolutions, where men are out in front while anxiously looking over their shoulders to make sure the women approve. Yeah. So, Iranian women had been empowered since the early 60s when they first earned the right to vote. They went through suffrage and got rights, and their rights were expanded in the mid-70s, and then they wanted to use this newfound power and take to the streets. And so that's what happened in 1979. The Marxists took to the streets to demand some hope and change, and it's too bad women are so micro, right? Like, it helps so much with child rearing. But when it comes to the macro realm, the long-term view of life, that is not their forte. You ever wonder why a 20-something-year-old woman would go for a 57-year-old man, knowing she'll probably outlive him by 40 years? Yeah, you get it. But God love them. Women, I'm talking about. If we could just get a better understanding of male-female differences and how our brains are wired. Remember during the Ukraine, when that was at its climax, I was talking about how this is the first war where we will know what the women and children think, and that 99% of people who die in wars are men. And I compared it to abortion, where we probably shouldn't have that much of an opinion. We should have a say, of course, and women should have a say in war. But anyway, I covered that in the past, if you remember. But the world would be a much better place if we just understood better how our brains are wired. But instead, we have lived through a time in our era, unfortunately, where they tried to blur the lines between men and women. And so we have young men who are feminine and young women who are more masculine. And we're not reproducing as much. People aren't having as much sex. I'm sure you've heard the term useful idiot, a phrase that typically refers to leftist dupes. So in a Marxist communist revolution, the intellectuals take the left flank or the leftist flank. And then once it succeeds, they find out that they're no longer useful because they're complainer, they're loudmouths. They're like professional complainers. And so they're going to eventually complain about whoever's in power. It's just a matter of time. So they're helpful as the revolution's being waged, but then become a nuisance afterward. So they've got to be eliminated. And after the revolution in Iran, the Islamists who took power proceeded to then line up the Marxists against the wall to be shot dead. And I haven't even talked about them hanging gays from cranes or pushing them off buildings. Or I saw where they killed a woman for the crime of being raped, which is unbelievable. And I've seen, 30,000 to 40,000 protesters killed in the last couple of years. Why? I don't know why we don't have video of that. That's kind of odd to me. It seems like somebody using a VPN would have snuck a video out of somebody being killed by the IRGC. I kind of see this action we're taking as similar to dropping the atom bomb on Japan, where the calculation might be we have to unfortunately sacrifice a few of our soldiers, which is awful, to hopefully stop Iran from killing thousands more of American soldiers and personnel and Israelis too. The last poll I saw was right about split down the middle as to whether or not they're in favor of this attack on Iran. I made a quick switching gears here. I made a quick trip last week to Costa Rica, and I opted for the flight with a layover and saved about 50%. So my round trip flight was $287 from Houston. So I fly from Houston to El Salvador, and the man who was sitting next to me, he was reading a book, a Richard Feynman book, who I'm a huge fan of. So I struck up a conversation about the book he was reading and how we both like Richard Feynman. Real nice man, 70 years old, retired physician who, this is an aside, but have you ever heard a doctor call themselves a doctor? I don't think I have. It is always physician, right? You ever wonder why that is? I tend to think it's because, like my marketing professor in college, he insisted he be called doctor in last name. And that's got to be the reason, right? I don't know. Anyway, so this fella, he had gone to medical school in San Jose, Costa Rica. And this was his first trip back. And he had planned to stay a few months. And he's now retired, as I said. And something I think about as it pertains to meeting strangers out in the jungle is I wonder how many more people you would meet if you always wore a shirt or a hat or something that would indicate where you're from or where you went to school or carrying a book. You know, somebody like me is bound to ask you about the book. So I especially think about that when I'm traveling. Like you could be in Poland or Thailand or wherever and walk past somebody who lives in your neighborhood, but because you weren't wearing an Astros hat, you know, they'd pass you and you'd never know that they live on the street right over from you or they work with your first cousin. You would never have that conversation. No conversation takes place. And you both probably miss out on a cool moment because where you discover like, no way, I can't believe we live in the same neighborhood or went to the same school or concert or you get the idea. And I say all that because if this man hadn't been reading Feynman, I don't know that I would have talked to him. But we became fast friends. Like when we landed in El Salvador, he watched my bags when I went to the restroom and we just kept talking and I got to know him real well. We got to know each other. He divorced when he was 30 and he never remarried. He didn't start medical school till he was 45. Just a real interesting guy. And he was telling me he now lives with his girlfriend of 16 years in Oklahoma. So we get on the connecting flight to San Jose. So he sat next to me to El Salvador. And then we get on the connecting flight to San Jose and he's in the seat in front of me. What are the odds? Like I sat in 27C and then 24B. And it's just crazy that we were sitting next to each other because we were pretty much the only two white dudes on these flights. And the thought crossed my mind that maybe he was following me because one time, this was 10 years ago, I was in Costa Rica sitting at the bar with my buddy Adam, shout out G-Bominator, and I was traveling with Adam and a random gringo, a white dude, started asking silly questions at this bar. Like he asked what the score of the game was on the TV that he could see just as well as us. And that's how he started talking to us. And so it seemed fake and he could see the score. And that was obvious. So, but he asked us and then he sits down next to me on a bar stool and it was clear to me that I was being interrogated. Like I would say something. I remember telling him that we were going to Playa Grande the next day, which is near Tamarindo. I was saying that we were going to do that tomorrow to see a friend of ours. And he just locked in. He was like, oh, you have friends here. And so I was like, yeah, I'm going to turn the tables on this guy. So I started probing him and come to find out he lives in DC and worked for a think tank. So I asked him, just being friendly and trying to talk about something that maybe benefits me instead of being interrogated. I said, what would you do if you, because he had been there before. I said, what would you do if you were here and you only had 5 days? How would you occupy your time? How would you spend your day? And he says, you know, Brad, I would. And I was like, I turned to my buddy and I said, did he just call me by name? And he said, yep, I heard it. And I turned back to this guy and I said, did you just call me by my name? And he said, no, if I did, I didn't mean to. Now, he'd only been sitting there for 2 or 3 minutes. My friend hadn't said my name. The bartender didn't know my name. And I remembered what had transpired the day before at the airport in Houston. I had on my boarding pass the four S's, the dreaded four S's, which means secondary security screening selection, I believe. So they pulled me out of line when I'm going through security, and they searched everything but my BH. And it took so long that I missed my flight. So I was pissed. But there was no amount of complaining or asking them to hurry. None of that was going to help. I just had to sit there as they went through all my bags. And then they didn't put any of it back in. So that was partly why I missed my flight. You're basically forced to pack your stuff all over again. So I remembered that. And then I've got this guy from DC checking on me at the hotel bar. And what's crazy is if I were doing something illegal, like if I were a narco, the way to get me would be to send some unassuming, older, friendly fella in his 70s or 80s, like a Lou Holtz type, or a Richard Feynman, or a Herb Cohen. This doctor kind of looked like Herb Cohen, who wrote my favorite book on negotiating called Negotiate This, but by Caring, But Not That Much. Because those are my favorite people to talk to. You couldn't get me with a honeypot. It'd have to be an old man, like Lou Holtz. So feds, if you're listening, jigga what money? That's what Lil Wayne said. So we're on the tarmac for about 45 minutes, and they've got some sort of maintenance issue with the plane. So they take us all off the plane. We go back to the terminal. We're waiting. It's probably an hour or so, and they put us back on. I'm not sure if we were on the same plane or not, but we haven't taken off yet. We're sitting there, and he's on the phone, my new friend, and he's talking in a low voice. And then he hangs up, and I see him slumped over in his seat and with his head in his hands. And the guy seated next to him, I can't hear what they're saying, but he gets up to get the doctor a bottle of water. And so I peek over the seat and I'm like, are you okay, my friend? Everything all right? And he says, my girlfriend just died in a car accident. Somebody T-boned her coming out of a store parking lot. And I was like, whoa, man, I'm so sorry. So a few minutes later, he tells me that I can stay at the condo that he's rented in San Jose. And I guess he was offering because, one, we were friendly, but two, we were running so late. And I'm torn because I already had plans that night near the airport, and I'd already booked a place to stay. But I thought, well, maybe he needs somebody to talk to. And I genuinely did not know. I didn't know what to do. So here's what I did. I'm embarrassed to say this, but I actually prompted AI, like, what would you do if you were sitting next to somebody on a plane and they told you that their girlfriend had just died in a car accident, girlfriend of 16 years. So what I ended up doing, I don't think I took AI's advice, but I asked him, do you feel like talking? Because I'm a great listener. And I'm sure I told him that I was certain that the guy that went and got him a bottle of water, that if I asked him to switch seats with me, he would do it if you want to talk. And I said, or would you rather sit in silence? And he said, thank you, but I'd probably prefer to sit here in silence. And that told me that he wasn't inviting me to stay with him because he wanted somebody to talk to. So I gave him my phone number, and maybe I'll hear from him again. I don't know. This was interesting last week. I have a regular listener who rents a farm in DeRidder, Louisiana. And the day he messaged me was the day that the story broke about the former mayor of DeRidder, a woman, a 43-year-old woman who allegedly had sex with her son's 16-year-old friend. What are the odds of this? It wasn't 15 minutes after I saw that story that I hear from a guy who messaged me who's got a farm in that little town. And I asked him about it, and he hadn't heard about that. And this woman isn't ugly, if you're curious. And this young man, the 16-year-old who was victimized, let me tell you something Scott Adams used to say. He told a story one time about knowing a boy who he knew that was victimized when they were 16. He had sex with a much older woman. I think it was a teacher, and he said that the kid suffered, like we tend to think that's a victimless crime or whatever, and he said, but no, this kid suffered nerve damage in his arm and lost feeling above his elbow. And he said that was because his friends were high-fiving him so hard. Now, you already know I hate the term sexual assault, the SA thing, especially how it's become, I hate how it's become this all-encompassing phrase that includes sodomy, like as if sodomy and a pat on the behind. Well, Fisher King said this. Fisher is a great follow on X, F-I-S-C-H-E-R King. And I tend to agree with him. He said, I think we reserve the term rape for things like a guy jumping out of the bushes and forcibly having sex with a woman on a morning jog. Or where a guy drugs a woman and has sex with her unconscious. This is just a Jerry Springer episode. Yeah. Prairie Putz posted this, and it's kind of somewhat unrelated, but there's a reason I thought of it. It's one of those helpful motivational tweets that you see all the time. He said, no debt, ideal weight, 8 hours of sleep, mental health on track, right nutrition, zero alcohol. This was my peak. I was 8. One of my guys asked me this week, I'm switching back to Iran, he wanted to know if there was anything that he should be investing in as war rages in the Middle East. And it reminded me of the first stock I ever bought. I was in college. This is 2003, in the lead up to the Iraq war. I learned that when Saddam Hussein torched about a third of the oil wells in Kuwait, this was in 1991, that a company called Boots and Coots was who put out the fires. So we speculated that Saddam might do it again, light the wells on fire. So we bought this stock, and I think it was 87 cents a share, and it shot up to over $2. And of course, I thought this stock picking thing is easy, right? But no, I think there was a lot of luck involved. And in March of 03, once the war started, it came crashing down because Saddam didn't do what he did last time. So I don't think we made much money, if any at all. So the lesson there is nobody knows what's going to happen in a war or which companies are going to benefit that you could maybe invest in. So I know in after hours trading over the weekend, when we learned that America was attacking, when America and Israel were going to attack Iran, stocks like Lockheed Martin and a bunch of defense sector stocks shot up in value, but that turned out to be just temporary, and most of them were back to where they were in February by Monday when the markets opened. That Boots and Coots company was acquired by Halliburton in 2010. That said, if anybody knows what we should be investing in right now as it pertains to the war, please let us know. Don't recommend a stock and not tell us when to sell it, okay? We cool with that? All right, let's talk a little bit more about Iran, since that's the latest goings-on in the best movie ever. Now, the way this works, legally speaking, and this is according to Jonathan Turley, who is a brilliant legal mind, he says, under laws as they currently exist, that Trump has 60 days for the initial prosecution of this war, which they're calling Operation Epic Fury, and then beyond 60 days, he's going to need Congress to decide whether or not to limit the war or to authorize more war. You know, something that goes undiscussed about Trump is his penchant for risk-taking, which is a very masculine thing. When we were flirting with communism and all the inherently masculine traits were vilified and labeled toxic, which is a lot of the reason the crazies hate him, which, by the way, I could love more when he called out the leftists for being crazy at the State of the Union. Because it is my humble opinion that one of the main reasons we have so many crazies today is because they, the crazies, were so effective at manipulating the language. I won't go all over all the terms they created again, as I did that last episode. But I believe the reason we have so many crazy awfuls these days is because men were afraid of women, afraid to call them crazy when they were crazy. And they proliferated across the West, these awfuls. Why do we have so many the F word? Do you know what I'm talking about? Same deal. And I don't mean gays. But when you can't call a white dude for Harris what he is, you're going to get more of them. So all of you men out there that have some sense of your masculine core, call a spade before that shit gets out of hand again. Because I do know it's all of that is decreasing significantly, which just goes to show you, yeah, it does matter who we elect president. Yeah, I don't think it used to be that way, at least not as much. But they hate Trump because he does just that. He calls a spade. He tells it like it is. A truth teller is not what they're used to. They hate him because that's what men do. Men are direct in our language. If a real man doesn't like you, you'll know it. Leftists would never do that, because they're more feminized and sneaky, and they'll lie behind your back and try to ruin your reputation or cancel you if they can, and probably some of them kill you. And so he epitomizes this toxic male in their view. That is someone who says what he thinks, and he means it, and he doesn't care if you get your fragile feelings hurt. which is what's inevitable when you're more concerned with the reality of goodness and couldn't care less about the perception of it. He's not going to do the performative empathy thing. That's a lefty thing. That's a sneaky white dude for Harris kind of thing. And then they do that with total unconcern for the consequences because they don't think that way. But as long as a leftist's most precious value, their highest value, is feeling good about themselves, as long as they've secured that artificial high ground obtained by way of signaling to the tribe how virtuous they are, they know they don't have to help anyone. They don't have to improve anyone's life. That's not part of the deal. That's not part of their work. They don't like to work. Governing is not what they're trying to do. Remember last week I was talking about we're not problem solvers, we're communists. Yeah, they're not there to solve problems. And so Trump is – one of the reasons he seems so active is because he is solving problems, a very masculine thing to do. I saw where the fat governor of Illinois said that we're in the fight of our times, whether we're going to be rooted in empathy or kindness. What did he say? Are we going to be rooted in empathy and kindness, or a country rooted in cruelty and rage? And as per usual, if you take the inverse of everything a communist says to be the actual truth, what they're saying makes a lot of sense, because empathy and honesty, especially honesty, those are antithetical to communist aims, to achieving communist aims, which is, that's why they have to censor you. But let's end on a positive note. I've always admired Lou Holtz. He is the sort of underdog, like I talked about Tom Brady before, how once he started winning, once an underdog starts having crazy success, people don't cheer for him as much. They want a new underdog, I guess. But the dude was, 5'10", 150 pounds, something like that. And he walked on in college to play linebacker at Kent State in Ohio. And you might think, well, it makes sense. Your best players tend not to be your best coaches. Right? Otherwise, Michael Jordan would be the next Phil Jackson. But he was not only not an imposing figure trying to coach these monster college athletes and getting major buy-in from teams, but he spoke with a lisp all his life and still became one of the most sought-after speakers in America. And I used to say this a lot as it pertains to I used to talk about motivation and the mysteries of motivation, why one guy might hear Lou Holtz speak and want to run through a brick wall. And the next guy hears him speak and mocks his lisp. We don't know why that is. Why inspiration might strike when you hear the same message from one speaker and it doesn't do anything for the next guy. Well, that's just one of the things you have to leave a mystery, why one guy's inspired and one's not. But there's something else I talk about a lot, which is you're not going to take to everybody. When I first started my career, I loved Jim Rohn. I devoured everything of his that I could find. And it was a combination of his voice and his delivery and the way he told his story. It made me want to overachieve. Now, by contrast, Tony Robbins doesn't do it for me. I tell the guys that I coach one-on-one that they would be wise to find somebody they like who's got the heart of a teacher, as Lou Holtz did, and stick with him. Revisit their content. And it's the same with authors. If you read a book you like, get that author's other books. Don't force Tony Robbins on yourself if he doesn't resonate with you. He might resonate for the next guy. The same goes for me in this podcast or my coaching even. If it's working for you, great. Continue listening. Continue to invest in coaching. If not, find somebody who does. Here are some of my favorite quotes from Holtz's book, titled Wins, Losses, and Lessons. What a great title. The theme of the book, or what he most emphasizes, is that winners embrace being disciplined and have a work ethic so as to create opportunities for yourself, while losers view them as punishment. They, discipline is punishment, or they don't want to work hard. But Holtz would tell you it's all about focus and overcoming adversity, taking responsibility, and maintaining a positive attitude, both in life and sports. All right, so here's some quotes. He says, ability is what you're capable of doing. Motivation determines what you do. Attitude determines how well you do it. Another one, you'll never get ahead of anyone as long as you try to get even with him. Next, never tell your problems to anyone. 20% don't care, and the other 80% are glad you have them. Yeah, not everybody's happy that you are succeeding, that's for sure. If you're bored with life, if you don't get up every morning with a burning desire to do things, you don't have enough goals. Don't ever promise more than you can deliver, but always deliver more than you promise. All right, I told myself I wasn't going to comment on each of these quotes, but boy, does that one apply to everyday life? Because it's something we all deal with, where somebody promises you something by a certain day or time, and it's late, and you're thinking, how have they never learned that it is so much better to underpromise and overdeliver than the opposite, overpromising and underdelivering? I don't know if customer service training is still a thing. It doesn't appear to be so, but that should be the first thing they teach. Always underpromise and overdeliver. Throw in a warm greeting with a smile, and that's most of what would be needed to be good at customer service. All right, a few more here. Winners and losers aren't born. They are the products of how they think. Yeah, I spend a lot of time. Oh, there I go commenting again. I spend so much time with my guys talking about mindset. If you want to know where to start, I would try As a Man Thinketh by James Allen. It is a great old book that has withstood the test of time, and I have recommended it 24 times, and I've never gotten bad feedback. Next one. The man who complains about the way the ball bounces is likely the one who dropped it. Adversity is another way to measure the greatness of individuals. I never had a crisis that didn't make me stronger. Right on. Everybody wants to talk about their rights and privileges. 25 years ago, people talked about their obligations and responsibilities. Ask not what you can, your country can do for you, kind of thing. If what you did yesterday seems big, you haven't done anything today. Next, I can't believe that God put us on this earth to be ordinary. Another one, show me someone who has done something worthwhile, and I'll show you someone who has overcome adversity. This was from a speech he gave before the Catholics versus convicts game in 88, which is a pretty good 30 for 30. He said, you have an afternoon to play, a lifetime to remember, but you do me one favor, save Jimmy Johnson's ass for me. You think that made guys want to run through a wall? I think so. Hell, I almost ran through a wall just now, repeating it. But his impact was so massive. Maybe this is, do I have another one? Oh, I like this one too. He said, when all is said and done, more is said than done. But not with him. He did both, I think. Let me see. I thought I had one more here. Maybe it was from Charlie Weiss, who coached at Notre Dame. I don't know. I've been watching a lot of his stuff lately. He did a speech, or actually, I was watching his Lou Holtz's introductory press conference at Notre Dame, and him saying, this is the happiest day of my life. I never thought I'd have this opportunity, and I just couldn't say no. And he talks about his obscure upbringing, and it was pretty cool. Oh, yeah, Charlie Weiss said, heaven won the coaching portal yesterday. The great Lou Holtz hopped on the express train. All day tough, intelligent, witty, charismatic, great coach, teacher, leader, one of a kind. God bless him and prayers to his family and loved ones. Yeah, I would also add, he believed that he was such a happy person because he found Jesus Christ early in his life. A very devout Catholic. Dead at 89. R.I.P. Lou Holtz. That's all I got for you today. Thank you all for tuning in. I welcome your feedback as always. If I got something wrong or you've got something additive, send it to me. I love hearing from you. And God bless y'all. Or as Lou Holtz liked to say, if you're not as close to God as you once were, I wonder which one moved. Bye now.